much for coming, and particularly for Deepak for coming again. Very honored to have you here and to enthrall us with modernity and with Vedanta. So we're looking forward to this and a lively discussion, and also a livelier discussion on Monday when we're going to have a ring in here. So I hope you're in training. Working out every day.
That's right.
Well,
thank you. Greetings and good afternoon. I'm delighted and honored to speak with you today. I'd like to convey my thanks to everyone here, but especially to Frank Clooney, who of course is not here. As he published the book that's going around with the Oxford Center, I mean, he published the book, it's an inaugural volume in the Routledge Curzon Hindu Studies series, which is of course in association with the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. So perhaps I should applaud all of you for putting, I mean, I guess in some sense this is our book or your book or my book, or let's go with our book. And if it gets really good reviews, then we'll say really it's our book.
It's ours except for John Rooney.
So for this reason, I'm especially pleased to be speaking with you today here in Oxford and to read portions of the book. I'm not going to actually read directly from the book. I've got some of it cut and paste here. But much of what I'm going to be speaking about today comes from that book and derives from chapters in that book, for that matter. There's much conversation these days about the ways that religious traditions are changing because of the overwhelming technological developments of the past decade. Adherents are embracing such technological changes as new ways to propagate their doctrines and to engage in their religious practices. For example, jet planes mean that people can move around very quickly and visit pilgrimage sites which once took months or even years to reach. Ideas can get transmitted rapidly by phones and now by the internet, and theologians are able to think together or against one another, think together despite being continents apart. My presence here in Oxford, for example, surely is evidence of modern developments in technology. At the risk of sounding like a reactionary Luddite, I think that such change seems to be beneficial at first glance, but in fact may herald the end of certain behaviors, practices, and doctrines that are integral to most religious traditions. For Madhva Vedanta, a 700-year-old esoteric tradition, I think that these changes could lead to its demise. Or, if Madhva Vedanta does not disintegrate, but appropriates these changes in the very fabric of their doctrine, they may be so massive, these changes, that the new version hardly resembles the original. I will speak today, then, about the ways that modernity, here understood as the age following the technological changes of the mid-19th century and the aspiration towards modernization and technological progress, has affected Madhva doctrine itself, namely the centrality of limiting the dissemination of Madhva doctrine. But first, a more formal characterization of a pedagogical context that lends itself to an insider epistemology, such as the one found in Madhva Vedanta, and that is now threatened by modernity. The pedagogical context. Some living traditions of thought, such as Madhva Vedanta, had or have educational institutions that require that followers learn their root texts from virtuosos who are themselves the products of such training. By the phrase root texts, I mean oral, printed, and electronically generated materials which are held to be canonical by the members of the tradition. In a tradition that follows an insider epistemology, a portion or all of these root texts may not be available to outsiders. Many of these may not even be made available to insiders unless or until they've met certain requirements, criteria, such as age, stage of intellectual or psychological development, or gender. Jayatirtha's Nyaya Sudha, the Nectar of Logic, and this is a 14th century text, for example, is a text that is taught only to the most advanced students at the Purna Prajna Vidyapitam, a monastic institution devoted to the training of virtuoso readers of canonical texts in Madhva Vedanta. Another example can be found in Aristotle's Ethics. Aristotle states, quote, a young man is not equipped to be a student of politics, for he has no experience in the actions which life demands of him, and these actions form the basis and subject matter of the discussion. Such internal restrictions are not unusual when training is specialized, and similar ones can be found in Western educational institutions today, though they are less formalized. A professor of philosophy, for example, is likely to advise a novice to begin with Quine's methods of logic before plunging into Frege. A biology professor is likely to recommend that new students begin with Helena Curtis's Biology, which is a standard bio textbook used in North America, rather than Lubert Stryer's Biochemistry, which is a more advanced biochemistry textbook used in North America. Maybe it's used in the UK too, who knows. Novices are often required to fulfill admission requirements in order to study root texts with experts. But why must the novice study with an expert? What about studying by oneself? Why is it essential to study some root texts in an educational institution and according to the prescribed fashion? The need to study with experts derives from the way that the root texts are to be used and read. Often the root texts of living traditions of philosophy are no more than mnemonic devices used by teachers and students to memorize and recall doctrine. The scholastic traditions of South Asian Buddhism, Jainism, and Hinduism, for example, have texts in their canons that are filled with short, pithy aphorisms, our very infamous sutras, or famous for that matter. These are rarely read without the assistance of oral or textual commentaries. The first aphorism of the first chapter of the first book of the Brahma Sutras is, "Then, afterwards, the inquiry into Brahman is to be undertaken." This does not convey much without a word-for-word commentary explaining each component. Then, afterwards, inquiry, after what? What kind of inquiry, and so on. And their grammatical relationships with one another, which is always the hardest thing to teach students who don't know Sanskrit when they're reading the text about these grammatical relationships that are translated. Only after taking Madhvacharya's commentary into consideration does the passage become intelligible. The expanded passage reads, "Therefore, after having met the requirements for eligibility, the inquiry into the Supreme Being, Brahman, is to be undertaken." Shorthand and coded texts, like the aphorisms in the Brahma Sutras, are often vague and ambiguous, or easily misunderstood without the assistance and commentary of an expert, who is a virtuoso reader of the text and its commentaries. Armed with the commentaries, novices are expected to become experts themselves and to teach the next generation of students how to read the root texts. When removed from their pedagogical context, namely the educational institution, root texts can easily become unintelligible or too vague to be meaningful. These kinds of problems are found in any number of educational contexts that involve the training of specialized readers by virtuosos. For example, instructors teaching in Western institutions are often asked by students if they can have the class notes from a missed class. Such notes are sometimes indecipherable to students outside of the class who are not privy to the coded language that has been developed in that class. They are sometimes even inaccessible to enrolled students who miss specific classes. Unless assisted by another enrolled student who attended all classes, or ideally by the instructor who composed the notes, students are unable to decode the root texts, namely the class notes. In this case, as well as those involving living traditions of thought, a commentary offered by an authoritative insider is required for a proper understanding of the root text. Novices, moreover, have no other choice but to study with experts and obtain their oral commentary, because it neither can be purchased nor obtained outside of the proper pedagogical environment. So the restrictions are enforced by the very nature of the way that the knowledge is transmitted, namely as an oral text that is heard and memorized by students and commented upon orally by virtuosos. Who is and who is not permitted access to oral transmission of Madhva doctrine? Madhva doctrine and the transmission of knowledge. According to Madhvacharya, quote, not everyone possesses the eligibility here translated as adhikara, for acquiring knowledge of the Supreme Being, Brahman, and for obtaining moksha, release, from the cycle of birth and rebirth. Not every enduring self, jiva, has full access to Madhva root texts, the source of the knowledge that is efficacious for learning about the nature of the Supreme Being, for obtaining release, and for learning the intricacies of Madhva dialectics. The Madhva insider epistemology hinged on this restriction of access to the root texts. In several places in his commentary on Vyasa's Brahma Sutras, Madhvacharya directly and indirectly alludes to his insider epistemology. Madhvacharya explicitly warned his disciples against spreading Madhva doctrine indiscriminately. Quote, having learned it, the knowledge, he understands the Supreme Being. He may speak about this knowledge to men. As he speaks about it, he indeed becomes greater. The instructions for teaching are spoken of in the Matara Shruti. One should not think, quote, this is a quote within the quote, quote, it is the aim, one should not think, quote, it is the aim to distribute this knowledge to many men. There is a reason for not distributing this knowledge. When it is distributed, the result is the granting of the knowledge of the Vedas to those not qualified. This is prohibited. End quote. There were rules about who could and could not have access to the knowledge found in the Vedas, and these were found in the root texts themselves. These rules concern the qualifications, adhikara, of potential students, and they pertain to both inherent disability as well as stipulative exclusion. Some were ineligible due to the particularities of their birth, while others, who were unable to study, were simply intellectually incompetent. For this reason, I will use the terms qualification, eligibility, and competence interchangeably. So adhikara really has those three flavors. All three founders of the school of Vedanta addressed the qualifications of aspirants in their commentaries on the first aphorism of the Brahma Sutras of Badarayana, of Vyasa. Then, afterwards, the inquiry into the Supreme Being, Brahman, is to be undertaken. In fact, such qualifications were frequently addressed at the beginning of Vedanta treatises. Before one embarked on a study or analysis, the practice was that one must first show to one's audience that there were devotees who were eligible and competent to study the subject. So it is no surprise that the Brahma Sutras, arguably the most important root texts of Vedanta, began in this way. Madhvacharya's characterizations of the qualifications, moreover, were almost identical to those offered by Shankaracharya and Ramanujacharya. Vyasa Badarayana, the author of the Brahma Sutras, did not invent this pattern of addressing the qualifications in the first aphorism, and he was imitating the Mimamsa thinker Jaimini, who began his Mimamsa Sutras in exactly the same way. Jaimini's concern about the qualifications, however, centered upon the right to learn and to practice yajñas, sacrifices, that were enjoyed in the Vedas and not Vedic study itself. The first aphorism of his Mimamsa Sutras was Atato Dharma Jignasa. Then afterwards, the inquiry into Dharma is to commence. Mimamsa scholars, such as Shabara, 2nd century, and Kumarila, 7th century, wrote detailed commentaries in this and related passages. The 6th adhyaya, chapter, of Shabara's commentary on Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutras, for example, is devoted to these issues of the entitlement, eligibility, and competence of insiders. Madhvacharya's insider epistemology thus has its origins in its Puramimamsa and Vedanta predecessors. And in a funny way, I feel like I should say that Deepak Sharma's work has its origins in Frank Clooney's work, which of course is Puramimamsa and Vedanta predecessor in this kind of nice parallel sort of way. Nearly every major school of Indian philosophy discussed the topic of eligibility and thereby established either insider epistemologies or open ones in commentaries on at least one, usually the first, aphorism found in their central texts. This practice points towards the importance of regulation of reading and other pedagogical habits, and therefore for the training of virtuoso religious readers. By itself, the first aphorism of Vyasa's Brahma Sutras, "Then afterwards the inquiry into Brahman is to be undertaken," is vague and inspires several questions, which I already mentioned. After what? What is the significance of then? And by whom is the inquiry to be undertaken? To answer these and other questions, Madhvacharya commented on the word then. The word, which is really the topic of my dissertation, a commentary on the word then. The word then is used as atta, is used as an auspicious expression and to indicate that there are preconditions for eligibility. Next, he, as a good Vedantin, I suppose, he confirmed the accuracy of his interpretation by citing a conversation between the god Brahma and the legendary messenger Narada found in the Garuda Purana that agreed with his. So as a good Vedantin, he found Shruti to back him up. Quote, "All aphorisms begin with the word then and afterwards. What is the reason for this? What do they mean? How are they better than other words? O Supreme Being, tell me so that I will know the true nature of things." Thus spoken to by Narada, Brahma, the most excellent one, said, quote, "The word then is used as an auspicious expression and to indicate that there are preconditions for eligibility." So it's a good epistemic foundation here is set. Jayatirtha, the Madhva commentator, further clarified Madhvacharya's point. He wrote, "He, namely Madhvacharya, states the literal meaning of the word then to be after obtaining eligibility. It is mentioned for the sake of denying the commencement of the inquiry into the Supreme Being for the person who merely desires liberation. In this way, he explains the term eligible." Taking Madhvacharya and Jayatirtha's commentary into consideration, the expanded passage reads, quote, "Then, after having met the requirements for eligibility, the inquiry into the Supreme Being is to be undertaken." The select few. In briefest compass, there was access for human males who were dvijas, twice born, and who abided by the rules and regulations appropriate to class, caste, and stage of life, ashrama. Non-human sentient beings that were twice born were also granted access if they possessed distinctive intellects. That would be intelligent birds and snakes, right? Because birds are born twice, right, from the egg, and snakes as well. And though one question that my cousin's nephew asked is this, to dinosaurs as well, and I don't have an answer to that, but I'm sure it's in the Vedas somewhere. Anyway, where am I? All other human and sentient beings that were not twice born were excluded from this elite and privileged group. Oh, do you know the citation? I'm just teasing. This small set of sentients who qualified for a Madhva education and therefore were literate or could become literate and approved readers and interpreters of Madhva root text. Right.
Sorry to interrupt. Does that include non-Brahmins?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Additionally, three heavenly nymphs, apsaras, mentioned in the Rig Veda and others like them were eligible for Vedic study. The best women, namely goddesses and wives of sages, were also eligible for Vedic study and to become virtuoso religious readers. It's a very funny set of passages about the wives of sages. I'm not going to summarize that here. Lastly, all women were eligible to be taught sections from the tantras, these texts called the tantras, though orally and not directly from the texts. An even smaller number of shudras were permitted access to the tantras or qualified for complete knowledge of the Vedas. These were shudras Vidura from Mahabharata and so on. More details about the sentients who can access Madhva doctrine can, of course, be found in this book that's going around. I'm not going to summarize more than what I have because I want to get to a different, slightly different topic. So if you're curious, then you can look at the book. A dollar a page, incidentally, but anyway. The contemporary Madhva tradition and the dissemination of the root text. What I wanted to do is give you a feel for the adhikara, the the rules regarding who can and who cannot read these texts, and that they were there, and only a very select group of people could read them, primarily dvijas. A few women, and as I point out in the book, sometimes these women are from the Rig Veda. It's not clear if these are why these women were allowed. They have fairly risque conversations. They speak in Sanskrit. Is it because they speak in Sanskrit? Is it because they speak in Sanskrit and have risque conversations? The possibilities are enormous. At any rate, but if you're curious, I suggest you look at the book. The contemporary Madhva tradition and the dissemination of the root texts. A great deal has changed in the South Asian subcontinent since the 13th century CE, and it should come as no surprise that the contemporary Madhva tradition reflects these new innovations and has risen to the challenge of modernization. In simplest terms, these challenges were the result of the colonization of South Asia, the resultant increase in diversity, and the inevitable change in the technology of duplicating and disseminating texts. In reaction to these, the Madhva tradition was forced to reduce the severity of its restrictions. After all, neither Madhva Vedanta nor Tulu Nadu, which is the southwestern region of Karnataka, were isolated from the changes that occurred in the rest of the subcontinent. How and when did these changes occur? What were their precursors? How does the contemporary tradition make sense of these modifications to their traditionally upheld beliefs and practices? Colonization meant that Karnataka was to become even more diverse than it already was in medieval times. Similar challenges to those faced by the Madhva tradition in the 13th century again arose for the colonial tradition. The response, however, as I will show, differed greatly, as Madhvas have been willing to publish root texts rather than to conceal them from outsiders. I think what I've argued elsewhere is in the 13th, 14th century, when Madhvacharya first began his doctrine, it was a very lively place. We had spoke about in Pratap's office that there was a lot of traffic there, and in the face of this kind of diverse cosmopolitan Udupi area, I've argued that Madhvacharya became even more exclusive about his texts and even less likely to disseminate them. However, as I'm going to read the last sentence, the response, similar challenge to those faced by the Madhva tradition of the 13th century, again arose for the colonial tradition, diversity. The response, however, as I will show, differed greatly, as Madhvas have been willing to publish root texts rather than to conceal them from outsiders, as they did in the 13th, 14th century. Though it is not known to what extent Europeans interacted with Madhvas and denizens of the Udupi region, Major Mackenzie published the first account of the Madhvas, which is titled The Account of the Mardha Gurus. Marda is how he put it, in 1804. So that's 200 years ago this year, as a matter of fact. Mackenzie may not have been the first to interact with Madhvas, but he was certainly the first to write an ethnography, or a sort of an ethnography, of the Mardha Gurus. Guru spelled G-O-O-R-O-O-S, by the way. So I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that one, but I'd have Marda. Anyway, one of the most important milestones for the traditions of South Asia that upheld insider epistemologies was the publication of the Vedas and their translations by Western scholars such as Max Müller, among others, throughout the 19th century CE. Though Müller had many antecedents, including the Asiatic Society, he had a significant impact on the widespread distribution of formerly concealed texts. This began with his publication of the Rig Veda under the patronage of the East India Company between 1849 and 1874, and its subsequent translation into English in 1869. When Müller and others made this hidden text available for public consumption, the traditions of Vedanta, such as Madhvacharya's, were simply unable to maintain such strong restrictions as they had in the past. Gautama's commandment that Shudras would be severely punished if they were to hear or even speak the Vedas was no longer pertinent. One may wonder if insiders allowed this to occur or if they could have stopped it, but speculating about their intentions of insiders is fraught with difficulties. It is likely, however, that this massive change in their social world was inextricably linked to the effects of colonization on the psychology of the oppressed. The colonizers, namely the British, with all due respect to the British here, were interested in the materials, and the colonized simply made them available. Was there a parallel effort by Madhwas themselves to publish their root texts? Or was this a situation where Madhwa texts were plundered, like pieces of art, to be put on display in the museums, or in this case, libraries of Europe, like the Bodleian, where knowledge was made into a commodity, and where insiders were forced to divulge secrets like tortured prisoners of war? Did Madhwas participate in this process of exposure, or did they struggle to defy and resist it? The first recorded publication of a Madhwa text was in 1867 of Madhvacharya's Mahabharata Tatpara Nirnaya, the complete ascertainment of the meaning of the Mahabharata. In the years that followed, a number of Madhwas themselves published root texts. Though these were predominantly from the tenfold treatises on specific topics, the body of text known as the Dasha Prakaranas, Jibananda Vidyasagara edited and published Madhvacharya's Brahmasutra Bhasha in 1873. T.R. Krishnacharya drastically altered the history of Madhva Vedanta when, in 1892, he published the entire Sarva Mula Granthaha, compendium of all the fundamentals, the so-called Kumbhakonam edition. This is of Madhvacharya's entire corpus. Since then, several editions of the Sarva Mula Granthaha have been released, and insiders have published nearly all of the relevant sub-commentaries in hard copy. The text, which at one time was only available as a palm leaf form manuscript, has clearly been extricated from the institutional settings within which it was to be read religiously. But even if these formerly restricted texts were published, this did not mean that they were readily available to the masses, like pulp fiction books available in local bookstores like the Borders and in the checkout lines in grocery stores. In the UK, are pulp fiction books sold in the grocery stores? Okay, it's a large part of the American culture. Though there is no evidence to indicate that they were, in my own experience, I can attest to the difficulty of obtaining root texts and the unwillingness of insiders to sell them to outsiders. One could not purchase them with the ease of buying a bestseller. In fact, one may argue that Madhwas may have taken advantage of the technological changes in order to make their books available for other insiders and sold only to a limited number of outsiders. In any case, there may not have been many print runs on the texts, so the few that were available may have been distributed to a select few and could not have been intended for the masses. A great deal of work remains to be done on the print runs of these texts, and I'd like to come back here and do some work in the Bodleian and see just how many books were published. I wasn't able to do that. I doubt it's too many, but it would be really curious to know exactly how many were published. And I'm sure the original copies are here in the Bodleian kind of thing. Besides, the schools of Vedanta are commentarial ones, and the move to publish root texts may also have the underlying pedagogical purposes of making texts available to students in the monasteries. Contemporary scholars with whom I spoke also emphasized that their intention is not, in fact, to make restricted texts accessible to those who do not have eligibility. They're only making texts available to those who are eligible or potentially eligible. Hence, they are publishing texts and distributing them in the only ways possible to make them available to those with eligibility. The logistics of selling books meant that they no longer have control over who could purchase them. Nevertheless, their intention is pure. For these reasons, one cannot infer that the publication of Madhwa texts proved that there was a complete and utter breakdown in the Madhwa insider epistemology. In addition to publishing the root texts that were all in Sanskrit, scholars of the Madhwa tradition have also published translations of them in English, perhaps myself included, Kannada, and other languages. S. Subbarao's creative translation of Madhvacharya's Brahmasutra Bhasha in 1904 was the first. Gosh, that was 100 years ago. This is very exciting. I feel like this is auspicious. It was soon followed in 1906 by a creative translation of Madhvacharya's Bhagavad Gita Bhasha. Since that time, translations of portions of the Madhva corpus have been published by Madhvas and non-Madhva scholars, myself included. Most of these translations were and are in English, and some, such as Suzanne Sue's, were in French. Others, such as Glasnop and Mesquita's, were and are in German. There are many more translations of Madhva texts in Kannada and other Indian languages, such as Govindacharya's translations of portions of the Sarvamula Granthaha. The pressures of colonial India and the adoption of new technologies resulted in the publication and dissemination of Madhva materials to those who are uninitiated and ineligible. But what about post-colonial India? We always talk about post-coloniality. What about post-colonial India? Are Madhvas more or less restrictive now that they are no longer under the dominion of Great Britain? Have they sought to recover their past and to emulate the ideal community envisioned by Madhvacharya? Surfing the Madhva web. You knew that was coming, huh? The largest number of publications of Madhva root texts has occurred since India became independent in 1947. In the mid-1990s up until the present time, Madhvas have also made use of the newest form of publication, namely the World Wide Web. There are a number of sites devoted to Madhva materials constructed by Madhva practitioners in India and in the Indian diaspora. Some were even developed by the scholars of the monasteries themselves under the auspices of their respective swamijis, religious leaders. These sites contain introductions in both English and Kannada to Madhva doctrines, translations and summaries of root texts, downloadable recordings of discourses of Madhva teachers and religious readers, and even downloadable copies of Madhva root texts. These are available to the masses and are not restricted in any way. They do not require passwords, and there are no charges for accessing the site. Unlike hard copies, there are neither limitations on the numbers of books published, nor any ways to control their distribution. Anyone, and this of course includes outsiders, can learn basic Madhva doctrine and can download the root texts. Scholars who developed the first site in 1995 were not unaware of the potential problems of making the texts available to the masses. The following was found on the site in 1999. Quote, "It is recommended that you not recite either the Brahma Sutra or Bhalita Sukta unless instructed in the proper procedure by a guru, teacher. It is, of course, the rule that no stotra, hymn, including these and others on this page, be read whimsically, disrespectedly, or uninterestedly." Though no reason has been given, the reference to the Madhva restrictions has since been removed. This may indicate that the tradition has given up on the restrictions. Has the Madhva insider epistemology broken down? Are the boundaries now permeable or merely nominal? Is the ideal community a mere fiction in the mind of nostalgic Madhvas or a thought experiment imagined by scholars such as myself? Or are there still restrictions despite the apparent openness? Do Madhvas respect the rules restricting eligibility, or do they scoff at their outdated and irrelevant past? Justifications and explanations. Madhva scholars have neither ignored the restrictions nor laughed at them. Instead, they have sought to justify their new activities and claim to follow the rules of eligibility that were propounded by Madhvacharya in medieval India. There are three kinds of justifications and explanations that are typically offered: untranslatability, awaiting the apocalypse, and pedagogical context. While the first two are based on religious beliefs, the third is based on logistical impediments. Are they defensible, or are they hasty attempts to patch up a quickly leaking ship? Or sinking ship, I suppose. Do ships leak? I don't know. What's that? Oh, they do. Okay, good. So it's okay metaphor there. Slowly sinking ship. Maybe somebody caught it.
It leaks air.
Leaks air. Really? Okay. Anyway, so slowly sinking. At any rate, untranslatability. Quote, Sanskrit can never be fully translated into another language, into any other language, is a fairly common answer given by many traditional teachers, pundits, when asked if they were breaking eligibility rules when they taught or published translations of Sanskrit texts to those who are ineligible. The belief is that translations can never fully communicate the essence of the texts as they are found in Sanskrit. The impossibility of a full translation of Sanskrit thus protects the meaning of the texts from improper transmission. The readers will gain a higher degree of understanding of basic Madhva principles. They, like women, Shudras, and unworthy Brahmins, Brahma Bandhus, who are entitled to only select portions of summaries of the Pancharatra Agamas, this is the Tantras that I had mentioned before, will be limited only to abbreviated information that is given to them by insiders. The integrity of the root text is partly maintained, thus given that Sanskrit is posited to be untranslatable. The view that there are languages that are untranslatable is not a widely accepted one. Such arguments are based on theories about the nature of language itself and their uniqueness. They are also linked with theories that a language can be independent of the community that employs it. This belief is an underlying epistemic premise held by all the schools of Vedanta, namely that Sanskrit is a divine language, that it is an intrinsic component in the very framework of the universe. Madhvacharya, for example, held that the Vedas, and conjointly the Sanskrit language, are central, and that they were still not even created by Lord Vishnu. The phonemes, the varnas of the Vedas themselves, he reasoned, are eternal and without a creator. For Madhvacharya, Sanskrit was neither constructed by humans nor even by gods. Such a position, not surprisingly, conflicts with ones that hold that there are linguistic universals, such as syntactic and semantic categories that are found in all cultures, contexts, and so on, which are the basis for effective communication between otherwise disparate groups of people. The belief that Sanskrit is untranslatable is thus based on controversial beliefs and premises. Clearly, it is not patently obvious that it is true. Are there other arguments that are dependent upon leaps of faith? Are there other justifications that make sense only to insiders? Awaiting the apocalypse. I think I like this one the best. Another explanation that is sometimes offered by traditional teachers to explain why they can no longer enforce the restrictions is based on a belief that the current era is Kali Yuga, a period of time when dharma, dutiful behavior, has collapsed. That the root text can no longer be kept concealed exemplifies this destruction of ethics and the social order. This concept of time, also shared by Madhvacharya, is based, of course, on the Puranas. In them, the universe is characterized as proceeding through a cycle of four yugas, ages. These ages, namely Krita, the first, Treta, second, Dwapara, third, and Kali, fourth yuga, are distinguished by the degree to which sentient beings of the universe adhere to dutiful behavior, dharma. In Krita Yuga, dutiful behavior is upheld, as you all know, while in Kali Yuga, it is ignored. In the introduction to his Brahma Sutra Bhasha, Madhvacharya cites a passage from the Skanda Purana that describes this degeneration of dharma. According to this text, the Brahma Sutras themselves were composed when Brahma, Rudra, and other deities requested Vishnu's assistance during the Dwapara Yuga. At the end of Kali Yuga, when the universe is chaotic and filled with adharma, unlawful activities, Vishnu will return in his incarnation, Avatara, as Kalki, who will destroy the universe and begin the cycle anew with another Krita Yuga. You know this story. With this sense of impending doom and apocalypse, traditional scholars can justify their inability to uphold the Madhva insider epistemology. They explain that they are merely breaking the rules because of the looming crisis of modernity and the complexity of a situation that is beyond their control, in which all traditional rules have disintegrated. They are merely following dutiful behavior in the time of extremity, apadharma, preeminently exemplified in Kali Yuga. Let me get a little bit more water. Avert this Kali Yuga thirst. Though this loophole is mentioned in Manava Dharma Shastra and other treatises on law, it is still not altogether clear whether a loosening of the rules governing access to the root text is permissible, no matter the extremity or circumstance. No matter the extremity of the circumstance. The appeal to the apocalypse may not be defensible. For example, Manu warns from Manava Dharma Shastra, quote, a priest should never, even in extremity, forge Vedic or sexual bonds with those people who have not been purified. On the other hand, he also offers a method to restore purity if one were to teach the ineligible. Quote, the error of sacrificing or teaching despicable men is dispelled by chanting the Veda and making offerings into the fire. Resorting to the Kali Yuga hermeneutic may not be a convincing explanation after all, given the ambiguities in the Manava Dharma Shastra. Either way, traditional teachers rely upon it when seeking to give good reason for their activities. These two explanations, the sacrality of Sanskrit, and the Kali Yuga qualification, serve to justify why teaching the root texts in translation and publishing them for mass consumption does not conflict with the restrictions. They also justify why, when the restrictions are broken, it is legitimate, given the mitigating circumstances. Such an account, for example, permits insiders to teach outsiders to read Sanskrit. In addition to these, there are other kinds of defenses that allow insiders to maintain the insider epistemology, yet make formerly restricted texts easily accessible and do not require such leaps of faith. Such justifications are based simply on the mechanics of transmission, the Madhva pedagogical context. The importance of the oral commentarial tradition and its use as a method for enforcing restrictions cannot be underestimated. Although the root texts may be available and outsiders may have learned to read Sanskrit, they also may be sufficiently vague such that they cannot be fully understood without the assistance of traditionally trained experts. Many of the root texts are no more than mnemonic devices for teachers whose oral commentaries are essential to decode them. It is true that the Madhva tradition has made all the root texts somewhat available to the masses. It is also true that some people who obtain the root texts may not be eligible to access them, yet have sufficient abilities in Sanskrit to be able to read them. But, in light of the importance of the oral commentary, reading alone does not automatically imply accurate understanding. Consider the following hypothetical situation. The proposition, "You are not that," has been kept concealed since it was first conceived. Sorry. Consider the following hypothetical situation. The proposition, "You are not that," has been kept concealed since it was first conceived, but has now been published on the front page of the New York Times and is available to all. Though the proposition certainly is readable, its content is ambiguous without a commentary that explains each of its components and their relationships with one another. Who is you? What is that? And so on. And what is really not? Similarly, the Madhva root texts require oral commentary in order to be fully comprehensible. One may argue that many of the oral commentaries of the Madhva tradition have already been published and that a live commentary is unnecessary. The commentaries often require, as many of you know, sub-commentaries themselves. Without the assistance of an expert in the Madhva tradition, complete understanding of the text simply becomes impossible. One may wonder, though, about who determines completeness, complete understanding. Who determines this? surely the evaluations can only be made by an insider, and one cannot know if the insider is telling the truth. The question of degrees becomes similarly problematic, for an outsider can only know that one's knowledge has increased, but cannot know how near or how far she or he is from complete knowledge of the Madhva root texts. For these reasons, the mere publication of the root texts is insufficient for outsiders to become experts. This justification is not based on theological commitments to the ontology of some Sanskrit or the inevitability of the apocalypse, but is based on simple logistics. Quote, "We have complete knowledge, and you cannot gain that simply by studying our root texts," end quote. Are these restrictions put into practice, or are they mere hearsay? Are the traditional teachers known to withhold their knowledge from the uninitiated or from those twice born who have transgressed the boundaries for proper and dutiful behavior, dharma? When is a Brahmin a Brahma Bandhu? From personal experience, I can attest to the fact that the teachers of the Madhva Vedanta still enforce these restrictions. I was born, as many of you know, I was born and raised a Madhva. But I am a so-called ABCD, that is, American-born confused Deshi. Deshi means one who's got Indian origin. But I am a so-called ABCD and have not undergone traditional training in a Madhva monastery, though I have studied for short periods of time with some traditional teachers. My liminal status challenged the eligibility rules of Madhva Vedanta the most, when I pursued research for my dissertation in 1996 and 1997. Could I be categorized as an insider or as an outsider? As both or as neither? The Madhva teachers with whom I studied often were confused by my ambiguous status, and it was difficult for them to classify me as either a foreign scholar, an outsider, or as an insider who is eligible to study esoteric Madhva texts. I did put myself in a position, though, where I learned about what happens when an insider is temporarily made an outsider. Broadly stated, my chief teacher, to whom I will refer as Sri Dronacharya, which is, you know, Prahladachar? Guruji Prahladachar. Now I've outed him, I suppose. Usually treated me as one who is eligible to learn esoteric doctrine. On other occasions, he treated me as a Brahma Bandhu, a wicked Brahmin, and, if I was fortunate, merely gave me summaries of the concepts. The issues regarding my eligibility were made complicated when my column in the Indian Express, Karnataka State's second largest English newspaper, was discovered by students and teachers at the Vidyapitam. I wrote the column knowing full well that my dual identity thus far kept concealed as an insider and as an outsider, as eligible and ineligible, might very well be discovered by scholars and residents of the Vidyapitam. The focus of this auto-ethnographic column, moreover, was the identity problems that ABCDs such as myself faced in Bangalore, who also walked the boundary line in interesting ways between insider and outsider. Was I Pakka Deshi or not? Was I ABCD or not? Were we treated as Indians or as foreigners? Were we insiders or outsiders? After a particularly racy column was published, racy by Vidyapitam standards, I gained instant notoriety, or perhaps infamy, in the Vidyapitam. The column was on dating and mating in Bangalore, the trials and tribulations that a single man like me confronted, and my far too many failed attempts to meet the Bangalore girl of my and my parents' dreams. I intentionally alluded to activities anathema to celibate student lifestyles and did not leave much up to the imagination of my readers. Clearly, I violated the Madhva rule that, quote, "Even if there is a little bit of wantonness, there is no eligibility with regard to knowledge of the Vedas." Alas, the end result was that for all intents and purposes, I was excommunicated. I was declared to be incompetent, anadhikarin. The context for such a declaration was Sri Dronacharya's office. I asked him if he had seen my column, knowing full well that he had. He grunted an affirmative, and then proceeded to give me a stern look throughout the ill-fated class. Ironically, one in which we looked at texts and commentaries addressing the eligibility of those who are excluded from the class system, the antyaja. So we're looking at antyaja adhikara when this happened. I arrogantly, little ahamkara, asked him at the end of class about my own eligibility, and he curtly replied that I was not eligible. He said goodbye, and then told me that he would not be able to see me for at least a month. Punished. No more was I privy to his helpful oral commentaries on root texts. Of course, I was on a Fulbright scholarship at this time, and I was there to study with Dronacharya. It was a very bad situation. At the end of the month, I returned to his office in the hope that my transgressions would be forgiven and that I would be allowed back into the Madhva fold. Not so. He was again quite terse and declined to assist me in obtaining root texts and commentaries that I needed for my research, despite the fact that the texts were on the bookshelves in his office itself and in the Vidyapitam library next door. I left with the insight that the question of eligibility was indeed a live one for Madhva practitioners today. The restrictions really did apply, and they applied to me too. Alas! I managed to get an appointment with Sri Dronacharya in late July, 1 month later, so really 2 months of danda, danda dharma. In the meantime, I dropped in as frequently as possible in order to show him that I was a true bhakta, a devotee of Madhva Vedanta, and therefore eligible to study esoteric doctrine. Such displays include innumerable prostrations, where 8 parts of the body are made to touch the floor, the Ashtanga Pranama. And I was very familiar with his office floor. As well as proclamations of the validity of Madhvacharya's positions. Eventually, my devotion paid off. I proved myself worthy, and he relented. After the meeting at the end of July, Sri Dronacharya smiled and asked me if I was going to attend the Tapta Mudra branding ritual that was going to occur in early August at the Vidyapitam. I told him that I was indeed going to observe and to participate in the marking the mudra ceremony. In this ceremony, the religious leader of the monastery stamp or mark the skin of devotees with up to 5 heated silver brands of a conch, shankha, and the chakra, the discus, both of course symbols of Krishna. The brand is meant to distinguish the Vaishnava from any other member of society and to mark adherence to Vaishnava and Madhva philosophy. The mark of an insider, really. Hearing that I was going to be marked in this way, Guruji Dronacharya scheduled an appointment within a week. Was this the ritual that I needed to undergo in order to be reinstated as an eligible Brahmin, to be no longer considered as a Brahma Bandhu, to make me an insider again? I attended the ritual. When I went to class a few days later, Sri Dronacharya mentioned that he had heard that I had the ceremony performed. He smiled and casually stated that I was now an adhikari, and then plunged into discussion of esoteric doctrine more vigorously than ever before. This anecdote about the implementation of...
Can you tell us some of
it? Huh? Well, if I told you in English, you see, this is a problem. This anecdote about the implementation of the Madhva restrictions proved that there was far more to accessibility than merely having the text in hand and the ability to read Sanskrit. Without the assistance of a virtuoso, one was still restricted. By losing my permission to learn within the prescribed pedagogical context, the degree to which I could study Madhva Vedanta was greatly reduced indeed. Though I was able to redeem myself, redeemability presupposed that I was once an insider and could have my status reinstated. An outsider who is not qualified could not be granted access, no matter the extent to which she or he is devoted. Other Brahmins, such as those from the Vishishtadvaita tradition, however, could obtain access and could be converted. Of course, they're part of that Adhikara group. Some concluding remarks. The future of Madhva Vedanta. Traditions like Madhva Vedanta that hold to restrictive insider epistemologies risk dying or becoming irrelevant. The numbers of students in the Madhva monasteries is reducing, as is the number of traditionally trained experts in the tradition. The logical outcome of this trajectory inclines one to envision a time when the last expert is no more and no one remains who can claim complete understanding of Madhva root texts. Like the dodo bird, the virtuoso reader of Madhva root texts could become extinct. The insider epistemology, which has been a unique characteristic of Madhvavedanta, may also be the cause of its demise. The Madhva tradition is not alone, for its Advaita and Vishishtadvaita counterparts have faced the same challenges. They, however, have loosened their restrictions. There has been a calculated effort to educate the masses throughout the world, for example, to promote Advaita Vedanta by so-called Neo-Vedantins, such as Vivekananda, who traveled across the United States, spoke in Chicago in 1893, and President Radhakrishnan, who used Advaita Vedanta to unify and pacify India. The effect is that many Westerners, Hindus in India and diasporic Hindus, are now familiar with Advaita tenets, and that it is more than unlikely that the tradition will die. Vishishtadvaita thinkers have sought to increase their numbers by expanding their canon to include texts written in Tamil, a vernacular language that is clearly available to the masses. In contrast, many Madhva pundits, teachers, have upheld the restrictive insider epistemology and have not embraced the inevitability of and need for a universal, global, and urban tradition. As I've pointed out, until recently, they have neither published many books on Madhva Vedanta nor made the Sarvamula, the Madhva corpus, and subsequent commentaries available to the masses. This exclusivity is changing, thanks to Sri Vishveshwara Tirtha Swamiji, who's on the cover of that book, the scholars that he supports at the Purna Prajna Samshodha Mandiram, and the members of the Akhila Bharata Madhva Mahamandala. These scholars are making the texts and teachings more widely accessible. Their effort has led to many ABBMM, the Akhila Bharata, Purna Prajna Vidyapitam, and Dvaita Vedanta Research Foundation publications. Additionally, the Purna Prajna Samshodhara Mandiram, of which now I'm a research professor of that group or affiliated, has developed a website, which I already mentioned, where devotees can download Madhva texts freely and easily, as well as read clear and concise introductions to Madhva teachings. Madhva teachers must continue to publish and digitize texts. But is this enough? Will it help to spread the teachings of Madhvavedanta and avert the dissolution of this 13th century tradition? The Sanskrit medium is far from inviting, and many Madhvas and non-Madhvas have neither the resources nor the patience to read the Sanskrit originals. For this reason, I believe that the Madhva teachers must also strive to publish readable translations of Madhva texts and continue to publish lucid English summaries of doctrines online and in print. Most Madhva teachers, despite being superb Sanskritists and scholars, lack the skills to convey their knowledge using the English language. The older generation of teachers may not be able to satisfy this need, so it is up to younger Madhvas to learn scholarly English and to publish in English. Not only will this help to propagate Madhva Vedanta to the non-Sanskritic reading public, Hindu public, but it would also provide a way, perhaps the only one, for Madhva teachers and Madhva Vedanta to prevent its disappearance. With its reliance on the rapid developing web technology, the Madhva tradition surely is making every effort to preserve its root texts and teachings. The impact of this technology on the transmission of knowledge is now being reflected in the theology and the pedagogy of Madhva Vedanta. It is possible that in the next decade, the issue of eligibility will become obsolete, and outsiders will be made privy to root texts and concealed teachings. Hence, there may be no limitations on the kinds and the extents of the philosophical inquiries made by outsiders. This possibility, though, is bittersweet. Will the changes be so massive that the new version of the tradition, resembles its antecedent? Or, alternatively, are these changes indicators that Dharma continues to dissolve and that Vishnu will soon return as Kalki to destroy the universe only to begin the cycle anew? Thank you very much. Okay. Oh, did I go? I didn't go on too long, did I?
Well, we start to exactly an hour. Very.
Is that right? Oh. Oh, thank you.
So we have time, I think. Is that okay? Anyone who feels that they have to leave, I'll let them know. Please feel free to disturb soul. Feel free to leave. If anyone who wants to stay for a few minutes discussion, you could take a few questions.
Please.
The first one really concerns the topic of eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you speak about the teachers, the acharyas, as the virtuoso to you, and mm-hmm. you don't really describe basically their qualities, which seem to me to be quite essential in Vedantic, in all Vedantic
right.
traditions.
Right.
So,
what makes them artha?
That's right.
Right. I discussed that in I think. Somewhere in there and in my first book,
okay.
right?
Okay. Because this is also kind of the seal also which protects the Madhva tradition from, the possibility of being disseminated widely and
right.
in a way that cannot be controlled.
Right.
right.
So you've got to fulfill the 32, good old 32 characteristics.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So if you can just, remind us so I can also kind of have an idea of how it's differentiate that.
You want me to tell you what the 32 are?
One of the main ones. I know there's like two or three main ones.
Shamadama Adi.
Okay.
No. Let me just check if can you slide that over here? That book? I'm not sure if I wrote it in this book or in that book. This is a nice thing about writing too many books now. Apta Guru, 82, 87, 91, 93. It's pretty much the classic Vedantin ones. I mean, it's nothing really that new. Maybe it's actually in this. It's nothing that you haven't seen already.
Okay.
But there are, of course, in Vyasatirtha, in his Tatpariya Chandrika, for example, makes criticisms of the Shankara's Shamadama Adi. But
mm-hmm.
He buys into Shamadama Adi. Sorry?
This is their necessarily.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. It's all, it's the classic 32,
yeah.
really.
Okay.
I mean, including things like, the webbing between the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Though there's a very interesting, I'm not sure where it is. I think I published it in Journal of Vaishnava Studies. The article on the Apta Guru in Madhvedanta, things about chest size and all these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
No whirl of hair, though. Right?
Okay.
But why is that? Why are you asking about that?
Well, it was that because simply it's about preventing dissemination, wild dissemination of the doctrines.
Right.
Now the other thing I was leading to,
yeah.
which is what is the threat really of having this kind of material on the World Wide Web? Well, I see no threat. Perhaps I would feel like it's possible for followers of Madhva Acharya to put this kind of information on the net simply to mm-hmm. give intellectual information to students who are interested, right? So there's the aspect of intellectually grasping the doctrines of Madhva, whereas there's also the aspect of spiritually grasping the
right.
doctrines of Madhva.
Right.
It's two different things.
Right, understanding and knowing, or something
right.
like that. Absolutely.
Now, the point would be, what's the purpose of giving this information just for developing perhaps an intellectual conviction about Madhva Siddhanta? Now, that would be my question. Why are the Madhva followers willing to give information simply so that people all around the world can understand conceptually what Madhva is, which would be just a kind of like perhaps a scholarly endeavor from the to respond to scholarly...
You think that's what... That's you're asking...
Well, I'm not sure what the purpose is.
Oh, that might be one of the purposes. I mean, it seems that a lot of their purpose is to kind of... is directed towards the diaspora Hindus in America who want the stuff up. Is that what you're driving
How
at?
How would that prevent the loss of tradition from a spiritual...
I see. Because it's just the intellectual without the
without the spiritual...
Right. Well, it's it's not as bad, you're right. But it's actually, I mean, I guess it could be part of a larger trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a time when they wouldn't even do that, right? And so now the question is how much are the walls tumbling down? I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see.
Okay.
Right, we'll have to see.
Can I just follow up on that one?
Sure.
If putting up this stuff on the website for intellectual purposes and not necessarily for spiritual, you still need an insider epistemology to understand that.
Right.
So reading either through translations or in original languages and so on, it's still not going to, even for the diaspora, the Martha diaspora, it's not going to help them, because they still need to get to somebody and learn those insider cosmology and go through like you did eventually. So if that's the case, there are two questions. One is, will that ever happen to these guys that live in the diaspora, or even in the Indian subcontinent? You know, the Madhvas all over India, you know, not necessarily in Udupi and so on. They have the same problem as someone in New Jersey or, you know, New York, whatever. The other problem, the larger problem is, this is a kind of hermeneutical situation. If knowledge is then limited by its interpretation by the insider, epistemology, to what extent would it contribute to knowledge in general? In other words, will that knowledge ever become knowledge, you know, in a universal sense that we as human beings could use it? You know, like how we, like, I'm thinking of scientific knowledge, for instance. All scientific knowledge is, like, there is a public epistemology. You know, everyone can understand it and use it and live with it. Now, if this is going to remain in private epistemological terrain, what's the sort of point? At some point, one has to address, the tradition has to address this question as to, you know, in modern globalized context, what are we doing? I mean, are we really contributing to modern knowledge? You know, we as human beings, I mean, you know, human beings are not living in any homogeneous, small, you know,
kind of
societies and so on anymore.
Well, the first point you made is an interesting one about the text. Is exactly as I suggested, is the texts are there, but the oral commentary isn't. So what? There's a drive now to record and film the Swamiji and teachers, and those are being put on the web too. So now it you could probably, I mean, it's one step away from actually having a pukka class and having that recorded. They haven't done pukka classes yet, but it's one step away. Right. And I mean, I wonder if they'd start charging for it. If they start, who knows? It's worrisome. So it's you know, I'm.
I hope it's not £1.
Well, right, that's another way to do inaccessibility. But you know, in a sense, Pratap, I'm speaking. I did say that I like this apocalyptic, right? And it's. I kind of like to imagine the worst case scenario. So I see this trajectory, and I'm seeing the future. If the trajectory continues, then this is what could happen. So I don't. It's not happening yet. It could happen. If it does happen, I'm challenging the tradition. Hey, do you really want to go this way? So I suppose I'd like to see myself as acting like a controversial theologian from my tradition. And I don't know if anybody will read it because it's in English and it's $100 a page or whatever it is. But I'll make sure they get a copy of it because this is the last chapter. I mean, not the last chapter, the last few paragraphs I've actually published in Tattvavada, which is an internal bulletin of the Madhva community. I don't know what reaction I got, but they let me publish it. The same thing about people need to learn English and, you know, and what is going to happen to all this Adhikara stuff. So I've really involved the community in speaking about and thinking about these issues. It began when I entered the community and said, I want to study this, and they all said, you know, should we teach this kid? And then I become a Brahma Bandhu shortly, and they really, should we let this guy back in? So I have been deeply involved with the this kind of self-reflection that the community has. Some of the things they do don't involve me, and then I ask them to think about it and justify it. So these justifications I got, I really got from pukka pundits saying, what are you doing? You can't do this. I know the Adhikara rules. You're breaking them. And they said, no, you know, intent and so on and so forth. So I am positing a worst-case scenario in this book to see what kind of reaction I'll get. And if it continues in this trajectory, then that's what will happen. We spoke about this a little bit in the office, about this globalization can lose the nuances and how much of the nuances are essential components. I think in the Madhva tradition, they are somewhat of essential components. So if you lose it, what do you have? second point you had about knowledge in general, which I think you're asking from a perspective that is not available to these people at all, and it shouldn't be, as a matter of fact. They're not. They're. What is Madhvedanta for? It is for one thing only, for moksha. It's not for solving oil crisis or whether or not Bush is going to win. Those are irrelevant. So when you're asking what kind of knowledge, what kind of loss will there be for global knowledge when this isn't part of it, it's an irrelevant question, isn't it? I mean, but it's like that for any esoteric religious tradition that has the sole purpose of that tradition is to gain salvation or moksha. The rest of what's going on is not so important. Or, perhaps more importantly, is that what's going on justifies or explains the context within which this esoteric knowledge is revealed. So, okay, so there are all these people who are talking about science and stem cell research and the Iraq and so on. It's Kali Yuga, right? I mean, so all the kind of knowledge you just described is already been categorized in the Madhva system, and it's not that important. Or if it's important, it can be utilized only to for punya purposes. So, you know, computer equipment is a way to get is a sadhana, or you, if it's used to propagate, right? So your question is an interesting question, though I worry that it was a little bit positivistic almost, based on kind of the positivism, that we're actually headed towards something, some kind of knowledge, and I really do worry about that. And that, it seems to me, is what's going on to a degree in academics now, is that people are moving towards a scientific positivism to replace the humanities, which I see occurring here at Oxford. So I do worry about the question that you asked. And I think that it would be sad if these Madhvas gave a damn about human knowledge. They should give a damn only about their moksha and about Advaita Vedanta and why it's wrong, right? That's what they should be worrying about. I mean, seriously, I mean, I'm not just saying to pick a fight with them, but that's what they should be thinking about. And the moment the Madhva starts thinking about the Iraq war and so on, they, or whether George Bush should win or what have you, then that's not a sadhana. I mean, moksha is what they're out for, and debate with the Advaita is what they should be doing. Go ahead.
Will we make this the last one?
Oh, sure.
How does everyone feel? Take a consensus, or are we a democracy or monarchy? Yeah, we have 20 more minutes on this tape.
Oh. See, technology is commanding us here. Technology, time, all this kind of thing.
Actually, I have three questions.
Yeah. Okay.
And one question, the first question is that what actually is the negative result if somebody unqualified learns or tries to learn? That's one question. And the second question, maybe...
Let me answer one at a time. The negative, I mean, that's a good question because it says it's breaking the Vedic law, right? And number one. Number two, there's the sense which you get in Laws of Manu and... to a degree, I mean, I think Arjuna says, you know, if we kill the family, then the system, false system of regulation, dharma, you know, dharma, you know that section in chapter one, right? Like one is at 134 somewhere over there. That everything will collapse, mm-hmm. right? So the threat is I mean, it's all upholding the varna system, isn't it? Come on. So the moment you allow somebody to break the varna rules, there are a few people who can break, but you let everybody break, the whole thing collapses, right? So it's complete social chaos. You know, cats and dogs flying from the sky, you know, red lights are not working anymore. It's this really sense of doom and apocalypse. But what's so ironic, which is really a wonderful sense of irony I feel, is that as I close the talk with, is that, hey, that's a great thing, let's start over again, right? So it's this really interesting tension about the social system is breaking down, we need to uphold it, which is, hey, the social system is breaking down, next week it's going to all collapse and we'll all, Kalki is going to come. It's a very ironic sense of the apocalypse, right? It's very, very funny. Or I don't know, it's funny, but nice tension, good old tensions.
Mm. Okay, so just in order to hold the dharma,
right,
the
right.
social system,
right.
That's the qualification.
Right.
Okay, I think that's easy. And the second question is that you talked about the issue of authority.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of curious.
Sure.
Who is there somebody who has like a decisive final authority? Because is Pope.
Dronacharya. go ahead. Swamiji's, the Swamiji's and Dronacharya. There are a few figures in the Madhva community. All the Swamiji's, of which there are eight. The Bala Swamiji's, they're people who are their underlings, of which there are at least eight. And then they are well-known Pakka Pandit types. In Bangalore, you're familiar with Prahalad Achar. Keti Pandurangi is up there too. And of course, this Bananjay Govindacharya, you're familiar with Govindacharya? These are the three top. And, you know, Panchamukhi and a couple others are there too. But and there's a slight variation depending on which matha you're affiliated. I'm affiliated with the Pejar matha, which is why he's on my cover, and why Dronacharya's words are final. So there is a hierarchy. I mean, it's a really interesting hierarchy. And of course, they trace themselves all the way back to Madhvacharya, right? Very interesting system. Mm. Very, very interesting system.
So it's clear.
Lucid. And as Guruji said to me, you know, if I don't understand, I mean, it's a very interesting game, if you want to call it that. He said, Guruji, Prahladacharya, if I don't understand something in Madhvedanta, and I say there's a flaw here, which I used to say, I said, this can't be right, there's a flaw here. He'd say, you just haven't studied enough. Look at all these texts here. You're not completely, you're adhikari, it's true, but you come here for 2 years, you have a PhD from America, come on, man, what do you know? Whereas he's got this history of tradition, and the history of a transmission of knowledge that's, I mean, it's close to touching, you know, the transmission through touching, close to it. So he studied with somebody who was also supposed to be great, who studied with somebody who's supposed to be great, and he traced all the way back to, it's not turtles all the way down, it's all the way down to Madhvacharya. Who, according to the tradition, who did he learn his stuff from? Take a wild guess. Sorry?
Yeah.
Vyas. And who is Vyas, really? Starts with the V, ends with the U.
Vishnu.
Vishnu. He learned it from God. I mean, look, who can you doubt? Right? So it's very interesting that parampara. I mean, that's what this is really about, is parampara, right? And the sacrality and the insularity of parampara. It's just a fascinating thing.
Hmm. Okay, just third question is
sure?
That why do you think the number of monks in the monasteries tradition is reducing?
They're all becoming computer scientists,
right?
Who wants to send their kid there? You know, all that. It's just standard stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
nobody
it's just not. Sorry?
Nobody wants liberation.
Nobody wants liberation. They want the dollar, literally. They want the mighty buck. So you go to Karnataka, you go to Bangalore, you think that most Madhvas want to send their kids to become the monastery? It's a worst case scenario. They become prohit. I mean, most people become a prohit, which is a horrible thing to have send your kid to do. Okay, can't they think, let them become a prohit? And the prohits are not in the parampara lineage. They memorize a bunch of texts, and like the Buddhists say, they're just like a bunch of frogs croaking, right? They just memorize the text, they don't know the meaning, they do their little thing, do this ritual, have a nice day, let's have some lunch. But the number of people who are full-blown scholars is very small.
Mm-hmm.
They can't find jobs, you name it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? I mean, you should ask yourself the same question. Why are there not scores of students here studying this stuff, right?
So it seems that the choice for tradition is basically, like, I see two choices. Either sort of try to uphold the Dharma, or
right.
The strict qualification, then it just the people goes down, the
right.
number of people goes down,
right.
or how do you say lower the
right.
quality.
I mean, this is just a question,
right? And then somehow try to survive, but with the sort of lesser degree of people.
Right. I mean, the question is how do traditions change? They all change, and the question is how much can they change before they cease resembling the original? I mean, it's really a question of authenticity, right? I mean, how authentic do you want to be? And in this case, unlike Buddhism would say, we don't really quite know what authentic Buddhism is, so you have people doing different kinds of things in Tibet and China, and they all are, they get together, have a council, and they debate about it. But we know what we have an idea. We know very clearly what was going on until 150 years ago. Or was it? What was it, 1804? And then 1867 or 68 is when the first publication, that's when the whole thing collapses. So we know what happened before that. You couldn't get the books, right? I mean, it really is a quite. I mean, it's very exciting. I mean, I'm sure Madhvaita isn't the only. I mean, most traditions are dealing with technological change. In Christianity in America, you have Christians who have embraced technological change, and then you turn on every other channel on cable television on Sunday, and there's somebody doing something that's Christian based on that program. I mean, all over the place. In this case, the technological change and the system itself, and the very core of the system itself, they're at odds. So it's just a very interesting. I don't know what's going to happen. I will see. What will happen to Madhvaita? That'll be the next book. No, that won't be the next book. That'll be book number 5 or something. We will see. But thank you very much for your questions and for coming and hearing me. It's been a real pleasure. And to be continued on Monday with the debate with Sean Marie and on Advaita Vedanta. Right? I mean Buddhism. I mean, sorry. Rosanna again.
One of those other things is wrong.
Thank you very much.
Very
I appreciate
good,
it.
Very engaging and stimulating.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Jean-Marie, there's about half a dozen jokes like that in here.
That's great. Yeah, the anecdotes are fantastic.
And there's another, there's a really nice one here about the muddled theology with the